All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the latest and penultimate Christian Perspectives in Science seminar for this semester. We've got one more coming next week. But this week, we have Professor Ryan Beebe to tell us about whale and whale evolution. Now, Ryan Beebe is from Calvin College. He got his bachelor's degree from here in 2005. And then did his PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology at University of Michigan. He taught for 1 year at Olivet Nazarene University, and in 2012 came back to Calvin and has been teaching here ever since. So let's hear this wonderful topic and this wonderful speaker. Let's welcome Professor Beebe.
Well, thank you, Lauren, and thank you all for coming on a Friday afternoon. Maybe if it was a little bit sunnier and nicer out, you wouldn't be in here, but I'll take what I can get, okay? So thanks for coming. I do want to point out before I start a second affiliation that I have on the slide, and this is the BioLogos Foundation has a speakers bureau that's been running for, I guess it'll be coming up on a year, and it's called BioLogos Voices, and I'm one of the speakers in this group, and so this has been promoted as a BioLogos Voices event as well, so I don't know if any of you found me that way as well, but if you did, welcome, glad that you're here as well. And just to do a little bit of a plug for that, there are a number of us that have a very wide range of expertise in this group, so including biologists, paleontologists, physicists, and astronomers, and philosophers, and theologians, and biblical scholars, and historians of science. And so if you are in a church, maybe, for instance, that would be interested in having some speakers come and do an event, or if you have friends who are at a church or in a school where you know that they'd like to have some speakers come and talk about various issues of science and faith, I'd encourage you guys to reach out to David or to Deb and see if you could bring in some speakers. There's a really great group, and I wish that I could always go to these events that I'm seeing promoted, but I can only get to so much. So you might wonder, well, in a Christian Perspectives in Science seminar, why are we just going to talk about like whales and talk about paleontology and evolution and these other things? And I think it's really apropos for a number of different reasons. One is that in recent years, the evolution of whales has really become, you know, following the title of this paper, a poster child for macroevolution or for large-scale evolutionary change. When we look in textbooks, the upper left corner is an introductory biology textbook I've taught from. You've got a series of fossil reconstructions there illustrating macroevolution. This was a paper in a pretty popular journal promoting just education and outreach about whale evolution. And BioLogos Foundation itself on the website, when looking at evidence for evolutionary change, has whales as an example. And that's really common in frequently asked questions sections of websites about evolution. So we see it everywhere, and it's particularly looking at the fossils in these recent years. And because of that, we also see that this is frequently critiqued and discussed by creationist ministries as well. Some of these, like the ones on the left, have some pretty substantive critiques, and I think some well-thought-out critiques that get me to think about things or maybe explain things in a different way. Whereas other critiques kind of border on the absurd. This is an older one from 1984. You got to love the quote, that the transitional forms here differ from the University of Michigan depiction in being dairy whales. And then I found this great illustration, which is actually from a creation science textbook as well, kind of trying to make this claim sound a little bit more absurd. And so in my mind, it's almost more important for me now than ever before to talk a little bit about, well, what do we know? What are the different lines of evidence that we see for this example of evolutionary change that we're seeing kind of all over the place? So that's what I'm going to try and walk through with you guys today. We'll do a little introduction just to cetaceans, to whales in general. And we'll spend just a teeny bit of time looking at some historical perspectives on where people have thought whales have come from. And then we'll start to work our way through these various facets of cetacean evolution. I'll spend a lot of time on the fossils, mainly because that's my expertise. That's where what we see promoted a lot out there. But then we'll work through some other lines of evidence as well, because I think one line of evidence or one or two examples themselves aren't necessarily super compelling in some sense. But when we look at all of these different lines of evidence that are independent, and that are really showing us very similar things. I mean, I think you'll be able to, I hope that you'll be able to see in the end why this has become kind of the poster child for large-scale evolutionary change. So we'll start with a question. What's a whale? I'm a professor, right? I want active engagement, learning. So what do you think of when you think of a whale?
A
Sonar, I like it. Not all of them, but many of them.
It's a mammal.
Mammal? Oh, I made sure I didn't hit the button too soon, so you're cheating up there. A mammal?
Aquatic?
Big? Right, those are all good things. What I want to emphasize here is that whales are mammals, okay? And they're mammals for a number of different reasons, right? And just in terms of how they live their lives. We know that they don't have gills. They have lungs. They need to get oxygen out of the atmosphere. They feed their young with milk from mammary glands. That's where the name mammal comes from, right? They have live birth with a placenta. We were just talking before with some folks here. They actually have hair, not only the baleen that some whales have, but some have whiskers on their snout as well. They have very large brains that are characteristic of mammals. If you wanted me to, I could spend the whole rest of the lecture just talking about skeletal features. If you want, there are all kinds of skeletal features that tell us something's a mammal and not a reptile or anything else. But what makes whales so interesting as mammals is that aquatic part, okay? And the term I'll use here is secondarily aquatic. That's really what I think makes whales particularly interesting. Now, what in the world do I mean by secondarily aquatic? Well, most mammals, when you think of a mammal, you probably think of something that's terrestrial, something that lives on land. I've got some of my favorites up here, okay? So, giant anteater, right? This is a red panda. They have the coolest teeth, I think, of any mammal I've ever seen. Cows are delicious. I'm from University of Michigan, so go blue on this guy here. I really like the look of star-nosed moles, but I think I've got some moles wrecking my yard right now, so I might change that picture out next time. Here's my dog. Anybody know what this guy is? That's an elephant shrew or a sangi, because it's not closer to an elephant or to a shrew, right? So we'll call it a sangi. The funny thing here is that I didn't know that was an animation the first time I put it on a lecture, and I turned around and see this thing chewing on the screen, and I was totally surprised. I've done some work on proboscideans, actually, as well, so I'm really interested in elephants. And then this is a chinchilla. One of my friends in grad school had a pet chinchilla that I used to feed raisins when she would bring it into campus. So I think for the vast majority of people, when they think of a mammal, they think of something that's terrestrial. Now, there are actually a number of different mammals that are what we consider secondarily aquatic, meaning that they have presumably terrestrial ancestry, but they've adapted for various degrees for life in the water. So we've got three otters up here. We've got North American river otter. This is a giant Brazilian otter. They're the largest of all the otters. This is a very reformed otter, you can see, with its hands folded, maybe saying a little prayer. They're their own experiment into life in the water. Then we've got pinnipeds as well, including things like sea lions and fur seals, true seals and walruses. They have their own independent origin within carnivores. We have sea cows, manatees and dugongs that also have a very interesting fossil record, another completely separate experimentation for life in the water. I think you'd pretty much make a closed book case that cetaceans are the most well-adapted of all the mammals for life in the water. So cetacea is a Latin term. Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
What about dolphins?
Great segue. Okay. Great segue. So when I say the word whale, I often use it in a very general sense as equivalent for cetacean. That's the proper term, and it's for the order cetacean, which is based on the Latin word for whale, which is cetus. And we have two different suborders of cetaceans that are extant today. We have the toothed whales called the odontocetes. Students know that I'm a fan of etymology, right? So we'll break down the words. Odonto means tooth. Cete means whale. So that includes things like dolphins and porpoises, along with sperm whales, narwhals, belugas, things like that. Then we have the mysticetes. These are our baleen-bearing whales. Misty is a little bit of a tricky one, from mustax, which means mustache. So these are our mustached whales, not like my dad in the 80s, but because they don't have teeth. And they've got these big baleen plates in their mouth. They take big gulps of water, then use their tongue to push the water out, and they trap krill and shrimp and other small organisms inside their mouth to consume, including things like the humpback whale, the blue whale, which is the largest animal that's ever been known to live on planet Earth, according to body mass. If anyone goes down to the Grand Rapids City Museum, I hope they still have it up by the end of the month, you can crawl inside a replica of a blue whale's heart. It's big enough for you to crawl into. It's pretty remarkable. So today we've got somewhere in like the middle 80 in terms of number of species of cetaceans. And every single one of them, despite the fact that they've got some different ecologies, some different behaviors, they're all extremely well adapted for life in the water. So here's our common bottlenose dolphin. And you can just see externally a number of features that help this animal to live in and move through the water really effectively. Its arms have been modified into paddles to help them steer. We don't have any sign of external hind limbs and this overall fusiform body shape. Those are indications that this animal can cut through the water very efficiently, incurring minimal drag while it's swimming through the water. It's got a specialized horizontally flattened tail fluke at the end that it oscillates up and down through the water to propel it forward. It's got this accessory dorsal fin on its back to help control with its roll through the water. Its neck is very, very short and stiff, so basically like fusing in its head with its body. Again, helping with streamlining, helping to reduce the muscle activity needed to hold the head steady during swimming. It's got nostrils on the top of its head. Just imagine that, right? Scuba diving, snorkeling, you run out of oxygen, you just pop up, get a quick breath, and go right back down again, right? It's a very, very useful thing for an animal that needs to breathe oxygen out of the air despite the fact that it's living in water. And this doesn't even indicate any of the internal organs that are adapted for aquatic life, the physiological processes that are different when you're living in a marine ecosystem. So all kinds of really profound adaptations that allow these animals to live in the water. So if we're talking about them being secondarily aquatic, presumably having terrestrial land-living ancestors, I don't know what happened there. There we go. That indicates that we really are expecting some pretty profound changes in the history of these animals. When you think about animals that are adapted for life on land, they're pretty poorly adapted for life in the water. When you think about animals that are adapted for life in the water, they're pretty poorly adapted for life on land. And so you're really proposing a significant shift from one adaptive zone to another during the history of these animals. And for a long time, the direct evidence of that shift was completely unknown. We had no idea how this might have happened. So this leads into just a few minutes thinking about, okay, what have people thought about this? And we're just going to hit some key people who have had some good ideas about this in the past. And we'll start with Darwin. So in the first edition of Origin of Species, Darwin actually proposes how animals like whales could have possibly evolved. So I'm not going to read the quote word for word here, but basically he says, okay, if you can imagine something like a bear, which we've seen bears actually swimming through a river or something with their mouth open, maybe catching insects as they're swimming along. If there were no competitors for that ecological niche, and this was like a fruitful way of living life, you could presumably imagine something like a whale being produced through a process like this. Seems logical. But he was pretty intensely ridiculed for this. And if you look at subsequent editions of The Origin, from the second through the sixth editions, most of this passage are gone. There's still a little reference there to this, but this sort of well-developed thought process is truncated in later editions. But he knew right away, right, that if you've got an aquatic mammal and common descent is true and natural selection is happening, that we got to think about ways that this could actually happen. So this is like a proposal from Darwin. Fast forward to the early 20th century, and we've got Remington Kellogg. Remington Kellogg was a paleontologist working at the National Museum as part of the Smithsonian. He actually went on to have a career in cetacean conservation later on and trying to save the whales that he'd studied for much of his career. And in 1936, he published this 400-page monograph, I've got a copy in my office, that summarizes every single thing we knew about fossil whales up to that point. They'd been first discovered in actually North America, down in Louisiana, Mississippi in the 1830s, sort of a steady stream of fossils coming out from there through the 19th century. There was a little trove of whale fossils found in Egypt. I'll talk a little bit about that in the late 1800s. And this was like the state-of-the-art monograph about what we knew about fossil whales at the time. Here are the two best known species when Kellogg published, Zygorrhiza. This is one from the southeast coast of the United States. I believe it's the state fossil of Mississippi, if I'm remembering right. And this is maybe about 15 to 18 feet long. This guy is about 60 feet long. It's Basilosaurus cetoides, so those aren't to the same scale. There are stories about this whale being found. So it's from Alabama, Mississippi, and you'd have paleontologists going down and knocking on people's doors to see if they could go out on their property. And they'd go in and see like a coffee table with four whale vertebrae as legs, because these vertebrae are about this long. They probably weigh about 30 or 40 pounds when they're mineralized. And this is a very common fossil in the southeast United States. Do those look aquatic or terrestrial to you? Those look very aquatic, right? Long bodies. But do you notice these? So I'll point out that this one on Zygorrhiza, that's a dotted line. So nothing had been found for Zygorrhiza. They're postulating that it had hind limb rudiments of some type. But they actually found some hind limb rudiments for Basilosaurus, this 60-foot-long whale. We're going to come back to that a little bit later on. But we already knew that these animals had things like this in the 1930s. Going into the next decade, we have G.G. Simpson. So G.G. Simpson, you might have heard of. He was probably the key paleontologist involved in the modern evolutionary synthesis in the early half of the 20th century. And I'd say arguably he's probably the greatest paleontologist of his generation. Did a lot of work in evolutionary theory and mammal classification. And this quote tells you that the greatest paleontologist in 1945 has no idea where whales came from. Right? He calls them the most peculiar and aberrant of mammals, and that where they fit in the mammal family tree is open to question and quite impossible to determine in any purely objective way. So we've had fossils around for about 100 years, a little over 100 years at this point, and we still don't know where in the world whales came from. And that changed a little bit about 30 years after Simpson's quote, and largely through the work of my PhD advisor at University of Michigan. His name is Philip Gingrich. So I'll tell you a little bit about his story as we sort of work our way through. We're going to spend the next little while talking about the fossil record of archaeocetes. And that's probably a new term to most of you. That's the term that we use for these very early whales. So they're neither toothed whales nor baleen whales in terms of where they fit in the family tree. We call them archaeo, which means ancient, so ancient whales. And that's the part of the fossil record that I'm going to focus on for the next little while here. All right. So the first key fossil that was found by my PhD advisor in Pakistan was this fossil, which is named Pachycetus inacus. So Paki is short for Pakistan, so this is the Pakistani whale. It was found in river sediments, fluvial sediments, dated to about 50 million years old. And what they found was the brain case, so the back part of the skull, part of the lower jaw, and some teeth. Doesn't seem like much, and in fact, I don't think Philip knew exactly what he had when he collected it. And what they noticed when they took it back and conferred with some colleagues was that the ear region was really unusual. And the ear region, particularly the auditory bulla, which is this little swelling on the bottom part of the skull, had features on it that we only see in cetaceans. So we don't see in any other creatures living or extinct. And these are adaptations that have to do with hearing underwater. Hearing in air versus hearing underwater are very different processes. And cetaceans have ear anatomy that's adapted for perceiving sounds in the water. And we see some of those features in this early whale. So this is what prompted them to call this a whale. And then, of course, it was very popular, right? This was a big deal in the scientific community. And it made the cover of Science. And they reconstructed the whole animal out of a skull and teeth. Right, so that's often critiqued within creationist circles as well. So we can talk about that later if folks are interested in that. But they reconstructed it as a semi-aquatic fish-eating predator that was probably spending some time on land, but diving and catching fish in shallow seas and things like that. So, like any good paleontologist, you find a partial skull and some teeth of something you think is really interesting, and what do you want to do? You want to go find a better one. We don't want to reconstruct the rest of the skull or the whole skeleton. We want to find the entire thing. So our interpretations are more limited, right? We're not going to be speculating about things. Time frame is a little bit problematic, right? So this was published in 1983, shortly after it was published, Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. And you don't want Americans traipsing around in the mountains of Pakistan during the height of the Cold War. So couldn't go back to Pakistan to find another specimen of Pachycetus. And so Philip delved through the literature, found this region in northern Egypt that had whale fossils discovered there in the late 1800s. It was a very remote part. It was about 150 kilometers southwest of Cairo. And it was so remote that in these papers, when you read the monographs from these German naturalists, they measured distances in Kammelstunden. Which is German for camel hours, which is how far your camel can walk in an hour. So this site is 5 Kammelstunden away from this site, right? So you'd walk with your camel for 5 hours to get there. And so all these fossils were discovered there over the course of about 20 years, and no one had been back there since 1900. Well, now things are a little bit more developed, and now he had whales on the brain, and he wanted to go find more whales, so they went to Egypt. But before we look at that region, you might wonder, well, why in the world are we finding whales in the mountains of Pakistan in the deserts of Egypt? That's a really important question. So if we look at a paleogeographic reconstruction of the Eocene, which is the time frame when we find these whales, this is what it looked like. So you can recognize North and South America here. Here's Africa. It hasn't bumped up into Eurasia yet. The Indian subcontinent hasn't bumped into Southeast Asia yet either. And we have a seaway right here. We call this the Tethys Sea. It would have connected what's today the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean. And you can see that northern Egypt, northwest Pakistan are underwater. So this makes perfect sense of why we find ocean sediments there and why we might expect to find some whale fossils there as well. So what in the world does this place in Egypt look like? Well, here it is. So I had the chance, really the chance of a lifetime, to spend a couple of months doing some field work there when I was a graduate student. And we call it today Wadi al-Hitan, which is Arabic for Valley of Whales. And this is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, largely through the efforts of my advisor and some of his colleagues. So it has become a fairly popular tourist destination for people visiting Egypt. You can rent a driver and have him take you down from Cairo. So it's a couple-hour drive. They have an open-air museum. What you're actually seeing is a path that you can walk between exhibits where they partially excavate fossils, leave them there, give you a nice descriptive sign for what you're seeing, and you can walk from one exhibit to the next. I think if you even pay enough, you can camp out here overnight. We saw some people in tents that were camping out in a particular area that was okay to do that in. But it's a really remarkable place. And this is a beautiful picture on a nice cool morning when I was there. But you don't see any fossils yet, right? So I want to give you a sense for what it's like when you're walking through the desert and you encounter some things. So here's my story. So this is a photo kind of late in the day, so that's why it's kind of orange in color. And you can see three people up there for scale. We had a National Geographic team with us while we were there, and so it was a writer and two photographers that were trailing us everywhere we went. And this is a pretty steep, sandy slope that you have to walk up to get there. And as you're walking up the slope, if you're looking at your feet, you'll say, oh, look at this. Here's a little fragment of a rib. That's pretty cool. And you'll walk a few more steps and think, ooh, there's a metacarpal. That's pretty interesting. And you take another step. Ooh, here's a partial vertebra. And you walk all the way up to the top, picking up fragments of bone as you're climbing up. And then you get to the rock that's eroding to create this slope, and you see things like this. Whoop, here we go. So this is Philip. And he's holding two vertebrae up on to the skeleton where they'd fallen out. So what you see here is a lower jaw with teeth. This is the rostrum of a skull laying on its side, again with teeth. And we often find these whales in C shapes because their muscles atrophy when they die, causing the spine to bend. So when they're on the bottom, they're kind of coiled into a C. And I would bet a lot of money that this whole skeleton is in here. Except for the tail. We've lost the tail. It's probably been eroding there for who knows how long, probably a century or two. And those are the bones that you're picking up as you walk up the slope, or from the skeleton just eroding out of the rock. So this was a really cool find, and there was just a German tourist that found it. And he sort of went to the rangers there and said, oh, you need to come see this. And so we went out to see it, and it was really a really cool specimen. Then we've got this, which was an excavation that I spent about 2.5 weeks on when I was there. This is Mohammed Sameh Antar, who is one of the rangers at Wadi al-Hitan. And he's sitting here next to some teeth. That's all we could see were three teeth sticking out of the side of this kind of rubbly cliff. This was mostly a shale. And we spent 2.5 weeks removing all the overburden. And this is looking down on it. We've got a complete skull that's about 130 centimeters long. This is a big skull, big whale. I think we had 26 ribs, about 27 or 28 vertebrae, complete forelimbs. And we couldn't dig any more because there was too much overburden to remove. We'd have to tunnel through it like building a train tunnel or something, which was more than I think we were capable of doing. And again, I would bet money that this entire skeleton is there if we could just get in and remove it all. These types of skeletons are uncommon to find them this complete and this well-preserved. But partial specimens that have been sitting in the desert and eroding for centuries, are extremely common. You'll be walking through the desert looking for things, and sometimes you'll stop and say, oh, I'm standing in a whale's rib cage, and have to kind of like back out carefully and see how much is there. Since the early 1980s, the University of Michigan teams have mapped with GIS over 1,200 different individual whale specimens. Now, again, they're not all complete and well-preserved like this, but a pile of bones that we can recognize, okay, that's a whale. 1,200 different specimens in a fairly small geographic region. Ryan?
Quick question. These are ancient whales or
these are
modern whales?
These are ancient.
Like ancestors.
Yeah, so these are about 38 million years, give or take.
So they're from the same time period, same kind of whales?
So we've got a little bit of stratigraphy here, a little bit of time, a few million years, and there are, I'd have to count the number of species. Like, I know that when I was there, I encountered at least 5 different genera and species through different ages of rocks when we were there. So what do some of these look like? So this whale right here that I'm working on is a member of this species. This is Basilosaurus isis. This is the Egyptian counterpart to that North American whale that's been known since the 1830s. And this was first reported in its entirety in 1990. 37 million years old on the date, found in marine rocks, 60 feet long. These vertebrae are inflated, extremely long. The skull itself is over a meter in length, so this is a big animal. And it came with this. Now remember, when we think back to Remington Kellogg, 1930s, we knew that there were some vestiges of bone that had been found with fossils. This animal has a complete pelvis, femur, patella, tibia, fibula, kind of a confusing conglomerate of fused ankle bones, and 3 individual toes. This was the first time in history anyone had ever seen a fully formed hind limb on a whale. All the bones are there. That in and of itself is really cool. But this isn't why, in my mind, this specimen was really important when it was found. This is why I think it was more important. So I've blown up the Cenozoic. So this is the time, the geological time scale since the dinosaurs went extinct. So 65 million years. And where we're focusing is the Eocene. This is where we start to see whales. So this whole span right here is the Eocene. The earliest Eocene is the Aprisian, Lutetian, Bartonian, Priabonian. Remember Pachycetus, the one that we had the partial skull, some teeth, really tantalizing clues that you couldn't see more of? That's about 50 million years old. Now we have Basilosaurus, a 60-foot-long, fully aquatic whale that still has a pelvis, femur, a kneecap, toes, all of that good stuff, and that's at 37 million years. So that's a 13-million-year window that told paleontologists, now we know where to look. We know what age of rocks to look for. We can propose what types of rocks to look for if we know they're making a transition from freshwater to ocean life. So we're going to look for marine sediments between 37 and 50 million years. And we can actually make predictions about what these animals might look like when we find them. So this is where you can actually show that paleontology can be a hypothesis-testing discipline just like any other branch of science. And once they knew this, and they knew where to target, and they can use the geological maps and other publications to think of where to go, they found some incredible things. So, early 90s, where everything I'm going to show you on the next slide is since the early 90s. Okay? So, one of Philip's former students, Hans Tevesen, uncovered this whale in Pakistan. My favorite name for a fossil whale, Ambulocetus natans, which means the walking whale that swims. And among paleontologists, we disagree about how aquatic this was. I would argue it's not super aquatic yet. There's a lot of lines of evidence showing us that it was living in water. I think it's still not great, not super well adapted for a fully aquatic life. Tevesen disagrees a little bit. But I think we both agree that this was an animal that was probably semi-aquatic, that was capable of moving on land. Biomechanically, there's no argument against that, really. This animal could have supported its body weight on land, but it was probably spending some time in the water, and there's different lines of evidence for that. So that was first described in 1994. A couple of months later, Philip described this whale from Pakistan, Rhodocetus. We didn't have a forelimb, we didn't have anything distal to the knee, and we didn't have a tail, but we had a virtually complete vertebral column with a pelvis, with a femur, nice rib cage. Again, this is another whale that looks probably like it might have been able to support its weight, but some tantalizing clues that indicate it might not have. So for instance, it has a sacrum that's unfused. So everyone, I do this in class all the time, right? So feel the dimples in your back and then move to the midline. That's where your sacrum starts. Right? Your sacrum is a nice fused block of 5 vertebrae that's going to help you transmit your body mass to your legs so you can support that weight. In early whales like Ambulocetus, it has a fully fused sacrum. Rotocetus has 4 vertebrae that are part of the sacrum. You can tell they are because they have a continuous structure, but none of them are fused together. And its teeth indicate that this was a full adult. So we're not looking at just a young individual that didn't have fusion occurring yet. So that's a pretty tantalizing specimen, but we want more, right? It's never good enough until you have the whole thing. We want the tail, we want the leg, we want the hands, right? We want the whole thing. Well, this is a little bit closer. 2001, another species of Rotocetus was discovered in Pakistan. This is a composite specimen, right? So this is partially this individual, but also the rest, the hands and feet that were found for another individual. And this thing is really weird. Okay, it's got the biggest feet that I've ever seen on a mammal relative to its body size, which would probably make it pretty clumsy to walk. But what would they be really good for? Really good for paddling, right? And we had complete hands and feet from this whale. The tail is being reconstructed here. Still didn't have a tail yet. Okay, and this animal also held the tantalizing ankle bones that showed us that whales are probably really closely related to even-toed ungulates, things like hippos and deer and cows. So this was one of the fossils that helped to clinch that. Pakicetus, you remember the guy that just had the skull and the teeth? Well, we found some more bones from Pakicetus. And this is another one that we as paleontologists disagree on how aquatic or how terrestrial it was. We still haven't found one good complete skeleton for Pakicetus, but we've got parts of skeletons that allow us to have a decent picture about what this animal was like. So you know a lot more about Pakicetus and its relatives. Dorodon, this is another one that I saw a lot of in Egypt. There had been some specimens of Dorodon known from North America since the 1840s. And one of my predecessors at U of M, one of Phillips' graduate students, Mark Ewan, did a whole dissertation on Dorodon, and we got a really nice full skeleton of Dorodon. This is another one that we have hundreds of. There are hundreds of Dorodon specimens that are known. Fully aquatic, obviously, right? But we also have found limb bones like those of Basilosaurus for Dorodon. Myocetus, the mother whale, was named because one of the specimens was found with what's interpreted as a fetus in its belly. And I was in the lab the day that this particular specimen was opened up from the field, and I got to study it as part of my PhD dissertation. You can hopefully see the gray coloring on the skeleton. So there's some on the tip of the snout, some on the tops of the vertebrae. It's okay to squint because you can't see it because there's hardly any of it. That's what's been reconstructed. So that is one individual where only the tops of the vertebrae, parts of the snout had to be reconstructed. Everything else is there, all the way down to the teeny tip, the last caudal vertebra on the tail. So this whale and its tail was the subject of my first 2 summers of research here at Calvin with students to try and understand if it had a fluke or not. So if you're curious about that, I can fill you in more later. This is a remarkable complete specimen, probably fits somewhere between Rotocetus and Ambulocetus in terms of how aquatic it was. This was one that just came out recently from Peru, Cynthiacetus, another very large one of these early whales. Here, the gray is everything that they have. So this is also a very, very complete specimen that was just had a monograph actually come out a month ago describing everything in detail. Whoop, here, my clicker is going too fast. I'm too excited. There was the subject of my PhD dissertation, Remingtonacetus. They're a really unusual group of whales. I call them the needle-nose pliers of the whale world because they've got these really long, narrow skulls. And when I started, almost nothing had been known of the rest of the skeleton outside of the skull. And so I worked with a couple of key specimens that were very complete and sort of put together a composite reconstruction based on about 90 other specimens that were just sitting in the collection at the museum, not getting studied. So a cool opportunity to learn about one of these really cool early whales. So that's just a sample. Those are some of the nice ones that I feel like have come out since the 90s. And there's more. We can put together a picture like this, which has some of the key ones that we've looked at. So Pakicetus, Ambulocetus, Myocetus, Rotocetus, Dorodon. Ordered by age, so that's why they're kind of stratified from left to right, with their presumed phylogenetic relationships. And we could look at pretty much any part of the skeleton. And we can work from the older whales to the younger ones, and we'll see trends, clear trends of increasing aquatic adaptation, of decreased ability to do things on land. Here's one of my favorites. So this is from the Mace Brown Museum of Natural History in Charleston, South Carolina. We've got a few colleagues that work down there. And these are four different cetaceans. So Georgia Cetus is known from the state of Georgia. I've been doing some projects on Georgia Cetus lately, about 41 million years old. Here's Agariza. Here's Xenorhophus. And here's a modern dolphin. And those arrows are showing you where their nostrils are. And so we see these oldest whales have nostrils that are kind of, we have some that we are on the tip of the skull. They aren't preserved nearly as nicely as Georgia Cetus. This one's kind of on the top of the skull already, and you can see those nostrils marching their way back until they're on the top of the head to create the blowhole. And we could look at almost any part of the skeleton and see trends like that. But this one is the coolest, right? Now, I'll admit that when we look like at a picture like this, it's an oversimplification. But the trends are still holding. This isn't inaccurate in any way. It's just an oversimplification. And this is because we have so much other stuff that we could try and squeeze in here. There are lots of groups that have these weird specializations. And we've got a lot of species. So here are the five families of archaeocetes, these early whales. So the pachycetids are the oldest, ambulocetids next, then the remingtonocetids, protocetids, basilosaurids, and then neocetae is a group that includes all modern whales. So that's, you know, the toothed whales and the baleen whales and their ancestors. So we've got 60 different species, give or take, of these whales that are spanning these really primitive terrestrial-looking whales to whales that are fully aquatic yet still have fully formed hind limbs. The vast majority of these have been discovered in the past 35 years. So this has really exploded. And this is why the fossil record of whales is seen everywhere in textbooks and on websites and things like that. But even this is only just part of the story, right? So there's archaeocetes right there. We've got our time scale again, starting in the Eocene. Here are those different families of archaeocetes. Neocetae, the group that includes modern whales, is summarized here in one bar. We can expand that, right? So any of the bars that reach all the way to the top here are modern groups. And this is at the family level. So we have dolphins on here and balaenopterids on here and things like that. Look at all these other groups that are known from the fossil record but aren't extant. So we could just as easily explore these different radiations of toothed whales and baleen whales. We've got baleen whales that still have teeth. All of the oldest baleen whales only have teeth, and there are some fossils that look like they probably had both. Right? So we've got all kinds of interesting fossils above and beyond simply the transition from land to sea that we can see all these different adaptive radiations that have happened through time and are well worth studying as well. So that's the fossil record. Okay? And that's, again, only part of the story. And I think that's the part of the story that we hear about most when we're having conversations about the evidence for evolution. But the fossils themselves actually tell us a lot more above and beyond just the anatomy, and just above and beyond the way things are changing through time. And that's where I'm going to head next, to look at ancient environments and biogeography. So I'm not trained as a geologist. Okay, I'm a paleontologist who looks at these creatures like they're living and is interested in biomechanics and behavior and things like that. But looking at the rocks that you're finding these specimens in is also very telling. When we look at the pachycetids, those oldest of these fossil whales, they're found in freshwater sediments, in river deposits. As we work our way forward in time and further along in the whale family tree, ambulocetids are found in swamp environments, coastal swamps that are probably brackish type of water. Remingtonocetids and protocetids, a little bit more recent, a little bit more advanced in the whale family tree, are found in nearshore marine deposits. And then when we get to basilosaurids, those are found both in nearshore and in offshore marine deposits. So you see that as we're working forward through time, the more primitive whales are freshwater, and you're seeing more and more fossils found in increasingly marine environments and eventually offshore marine environments. We can also look at a completely independent line of evidence for this. And that's looking at stable isotopes that are present in the teeth and bone of these animals. So maybe just a teeny bit of background first. And I'm not a chemist, so bear with me, okay? Isotopes, you know what isotopes are, right? When we can have different atoms that have different molecular weights due to a varying number of neutrons, right? So we've got three stable isotopes of oxygen, 16, 17, and 18. Because of the way the water cycle works, oxygen in ocean water has a higher proportion of heavy oxygen. Okay? So you have more oxygen 18 in ocean water than you do in fresh water. Now, when we ingest water, the oxygen from that water can actually be incorporated into our tissues, into our bones, and into our teeth. And so you could expect to sample the teeth and bones of fossils and see, well, what proportion of heavy oxygen is there in it? And we can use modern things to actually help us verify all of this. So when we look at those pachycetids, those older, more primitive whales, they have oxygen-18 ratios that are equivalent to freshwater organisms, saying that they're not really ingesting, incidentally, any seawater at all. Then we look at Remington acetids. We're a little bit more oxygen-18, indicating probably a mix of freshwater and ocean water. By the time we get into some of these derived protocetids, into those basilosaurids, their oxygen-18 isotopes from their teeth and their bones are indistinguishable from modern marine organisms. So here's two separate lines of evidence, completely separate lines of evidence, that are telling you the same thing, that the earliest whales are ingesting freshwater, and as you go forward through the tree and through time, you have whales that are ingesting more and more ocean water until it's indistinguishable from something that lives in the ocean full time. So that's something else that the fossils can tell us. One more thing that the fossils can tell us, which is a really cool story: biogeography. So here's this world map of the early Eocene, like I showed you before. And I want to show you where these fossils are found. Right? So our pachycetids first. All the pachycetids that we know of are in India and Pakistan. Ambulocetids, every ambulocetid we know of, India and Pakistan. Remington acetids next. Until some work that we did recently, everyone was in India and Pakistan, but we recently found one in Egypt. Just one. But that's telling you something, right? Protocetids, the next group here, start to find them a little bit more widespread. And basilosaurids we find all over the place, including New Zealand, Antarctica, all throughout Europe. That's a pretty compelling story too, right? So it seems like the ancestors of whales probably started to get wet in India and Pakistan. And all of those more primitive forms that aren't well adapted for life in water yet couldn't get very far. And that we only know them from there at this point. We were thrilled when that Remington acetid was found in Egypt. I'd been saying through my dissertation, I think these guys could swim pretty well. But we hadn't found them anywhere else yet. And I had graduated, and they went to Egypt, and they found a partial specimen and said, I think this might be a Remington acetid. Give Ryan a call. So got the call 2 days before Christmas when they got back from Egypt. We have something you got to come see. And I came out to Michigan on my spring break. I was at Olivet that year. And I knew in 60 seconds that, yes, it was a Remington acetid, and no, it was not like anything we'd seen before. So that was pretty cool to see that group somewhere where we didn't necessarily expect them. But this is still a really compelling story, right? That these aquatic whales are the only ones, these fully aquatic whales are the only ones that we see all over the world. All right. Hanging with me still? Right? I don't see anybody nodding off. That thrills me, okay? Doesn't happen in my 9 o'clock class every day. Let's talk a little bit about anatomy then. Because, you know, it might seem maybe silly to talk about anatomical evidence for whales' ancestry when we've talked about all these fossils. But remember that we didn't have these fossils for a long time. And so the comparative anatomy in and of itself has some hints that cetaceans had terrestrial ancestors. Let's look at skull anatomy, for example. Okay, so you're looking at a top view, a dorsal view of these skulls. We've got a bottlenose dolphin on the top and a gray fox like we have in Michigan on the bottom. And particular bones of the face are color-coded. Cetaceans have an extremely modified skull, partially for hearing underwater, partially for feeding the way they do, but often largely to move those nostrils to the top of the head. Their skulls are what we call telescoped. So if you picture like an old spyglass that you can sort of push in on itself, all these bones are overlapping on top of each other on the face like a telescope, like the parts of a telescope would. Yet every single bone that we find in the skull of a fox, or the skull of a human, or the skull of a porcupine, is found in the skull of a whale. And their basic relationship to one another is the same. I love putting a dolphin skull on a comparative anatomy like lab quiz, right? Because that's one where you really show if students know their stuff, if they can find all the relationships and figure out what bone that is, okay? So that's a really cool example. We could also look at the neck. Remember we talked about how their neck gets short and stiff, kind of fuses the head in with the rest of the body. Almost all mammals have 7 cervical vertebrae. You, your dog, a giraffe, a dolphin, all have 7 vertebrae. There are some very few exceptions. That could be a whole lecture. It's really interesting to look at the exceptions. But every single whale that I've ever seen has 7 cervical vertebrae. But what happens in modern whales is they're really, really short, and they're almost always fused together. There are some whales that just have all seven vertebrae fused together in a solid block. Some have just a few of them fused together, a few of them separate. And you can actually see in the fossil record, this is another trend, the cervical vertebrae getting shorter and shorter due relative to their height and width as you move forward to aquatic whales. But there's another great example. Despite an extremely different function, we still have this basic architecture that's the same. One more, we could look at forelimbs as well. Right? We can look at these flippers, these arms that have been modified to help these whales to steer, and again, see all the same components. This is very, very common in a textbook to see homologies illustrated like this. But I think this is even cooler. We have all kinds of different flipper shapes in whales as well that are being used in different ways for different things, yet the underlying architecture of all of those is still the same as well. So in and of themselves, right, just the anatomical evidence is still pretty compelling, maybe not so compelling since I showed the cool fossils first, but still pretty interesting. Well, how about some things that we don't actually see in the adults anymore? What about some things that we see happening during development? Are there any hints there that cetaceans might have had terrestrial ancestors? Well, here's a good one, right? So here's a pantropical spotted dolphin swimming there, and here are some different embryos of that species at different stages. We see hind limbs start to develop in virtually every whale that's been studied, and they've actually done studies on the cell signaling here that show it's the exact same signaling pathways that cause legs to develop in dogs and cats and humans and everything else. But what happens is that this developmental programming is truncated. So the limbs start to develop, and then around stage 16 here, it truncates, and those hind limbs are kind of resorbed back into the body again. What's interesting is that when we look at the adults, they've still got stuff there. So that hind limb development process actually does produce bony elements here. Okay, so you're starting to see these more and more at museums where they have skeletons mounted. They used to not mount these bones, but now they usually do. And they're hind limb splints, right, that might have different sizes and shapes depending on the species, but they're developing in the place where you would expect the hind limbs to be. They're developing where those hind limb buds started. And occasionally you get really weird stuff. This is a dolphin caught off the coast of Japan in 2006, and it actually has external hind fins. That doesn't normally happen. But the programming to develop it is there, and this one presumably has a mutation that didn't shut off that developmental program when it often does. We talked about the blowholes already. This is really cool. Early whales, the nostrils start on the end of the face, just like they would in a dog or a cat. And over the course of development, the nostrils migrate to the top of the skull. So again, maybe by itself might not be super compelling or sort of convincing evidence of terrestrial ancestry, but certainly some really interesting hints of things that start you to get thinking along this route. So one more set, I want to have time for questions. So one more sort of group of pieces of evidence that, again, we don't see when we just look at the skeleton or we look at the fossils, looking at the genetics. We're looking at genomic sequences of some of these different whales. One of the things that has to change the most between life on land and life in the water is your sensory systems. Smell and taste don't really work in the water very well for these different organisms, and chemoreception in aquatic vertebrates in general is often very different. Yet strangely, when we look at the genomes of cetaceans, they've still got genes for proteins involved in smell and taste. So here was a study that came out. Gracious, it's 9 years ago already. That's starting to make me feel old, right? So this is a study that's looking for olfactory receptor genes. So in order for your sense of smell to work, you have to have proteins attached to olfactory sensory receptors in your nose that can bind to airborne molecules. Those are the olfactory receptors. And basing their search on olfactory receptor DNA sequences in cows, they went looking in whale genomes. And boy, they found some olfactory receptor genes in these cetaceans. Now, strangely, well, maybe not so strangely, most of them are pseudogenes. And I'm guessing a lot of you know what pseudogenes are, but in case you don't, a pseudogene is a sequence of DNA that's recognizable as a gene, right? You might recognize the promoter and the operator and all the different parts that are involved in regulating that gene, but it's accumulated enough mutations in there that it's not functional anymore. So when we look at these olfactory receptor genes in these cetaceans, almost 80% of them are pseudogenes, which is actually probably what we would expect if they're not using their sense of smell anymore. And we'd known based on brain structure that and the lack of an olfactory bulb that they probably weren't smelling things in the way that we are accustomed to it with terrestrial mammals. But now looking at the DNA, it actually makes sense that they don't even have functional genes to pick up on it. What's really cool is you can actually pinpoint the mutations by comparing them with something like a cow. And you can actually use them to help you do phylogeny, help them reconstruct the relationships of these different cetaceans because they inherit and often share these same mutations in the different lineages. How about taste? Well, when we look for taste receptor genes, we have way fewer than we would expect from a mammal within cetaceans. We can actually recognize the gene for gustucin. Gustucin is a specialized G protein that's involved in signal transduction in taste receptor cells involved with three different sensations, with sweet, with umami, and with bitter. And we can find gustucin here. And one part of gustucin, the alpha unit of it, is a pseudogene. And you can actually see exactly what kind of pseudogene it is. It causes a frameshift mutation that results in a premature stop codon. So the biology students in here should think back to cell bio and, oh, yeah, that's one of the mutations that we talked about, right? And you can look in the genome and see that that mutation is shared in all the cetaceans that they sampled here. And so it looks like gustucin was probably lost in the common ancestor of all modern whales. So this would have happened probably maybe within the archaeocetes that we looked at before. One of my favorite genetic examples is a little bit farther up in the tree, looking at baleen whales. So remember, baleen whales don't have teeth as adults. Many of them do have tooth buds that start to develop in the jaw, but never complete development. But when we look at the genetics of these baleen whales, they've actually got enamel-specific genes present in their genome that have also degraded into pseudogenes. So these are animals that have almost everything they need to make enamel, despite the fact that they don't have any teeth as adults. So three just pretty cool examples of what we can learn from genetics as well. So to summarize and give you guys a few minutes to ask some questions, hopefully you see that this is a pretty compelling story. We're looking at one particular evolutionary transition, and we're looking at examples or cases of trying to reconstruct their evolutionary history. And what we see when we look at fossils is they have the intermediate anatomies we'd predict. We find them where we would expect them, both geographically and environmentally. We find them when we expect to see them, based on the dating. And that by itself is really compelling. When we look at anatomy and development, we see things happening there that don't make a lot of sense unless these animals had terrestrial ancestry. And when we take genetics into account, we're being able to unpack how these changes occurred at unprecedented levels of detail. I don't think anyone would have imagined that you'd be able to sort of pinpoint where the mutations are, when they probably happened in the phylogeny by looking where the mutations are shared. And when we have all of these different independent lines of evidence converging on a common story, I think it's really compelling. So to pull back to this picture that you saw early on, I know that Philip was really proud of this when he had the museum artist construct this one, right? We've put together quite a bit of this story. There's still a lot to learn, and I'm really interested in a lot of these details, especially my focus has been on locomotion and how you move from an animal that's presumably swimming by paddling four legs like a dog to an animal that doesn't use its legs at all, has a modified tail, and is using that to swim. I'm really interested in the biomechanics and understanding how that transition happens. So there's so much still to learn, but I think the reason we see this everywhere, in textbooks, on websites, and everywhere else, is because it deserves to be held up as a really compelling example, given all the evidence I walk you through. So I'll take a breather, get some water. You can laugh at some of these cetacean cartoons, and I'd be happy to take any questions from you guys.
Mm-hmm. Or was it just some little weird lineage where it just kind of stays?
I'd have to check. What I'd have to check is if we know anything about the fossils at the divergence between like dolphins and the monodontids, where the belugas are from. I would expect that could have easily been a loss of fusion again. That's a type of event that I don't think is that uncommon. Even within particular groups, like particular species of whales, you can see some variance in terms of how many vertebrae are fused and where exactly they're fused. What we tend to see is cetaceans that are really high-speed swimmers, where it would be beneficial to not have to use any muscle to control that head, tend to have everything fused together. Others, where it's actually beneficial to maybe have their head be a little mobile, might lack them completely. So one of my favorites is the Amazon River dolphin. It's known when the Amazon River floods. So this is cool. Well, I'll step back. There are freshwater cetaceans as well that have reinvaded freshwater environments from the ocean. And the Amazon River dolphin is one. And it's known when the Amazon floods that these things will go swimming through the flooded forest in the water. And so there's tree trunks and all kinds of vegetation, and they need to be laterally flexible to get through the environment, and they'll be bending and moving their heads side to side to help them navigate it. They've got the longest cervical vertebrae compared to overall body size of any of the whales that we have today. So there's tons of variation there. I'd have to check on your particular question, though, to see if any of the fossils showed signs of fusion or not. Really good question. Yeah?
From the start, did evolutionists assume that whales must have evolved from land mammals rather than wondering if being a mammal evolved from?
That's a good question. I think we'd known for quite a long period of time that the oldest mammals that were known were terrestrial. And so that would imply then if all mammals are descended from a common mammalian ancestor, then any of the aquatic ones needed to come from a terrestrial ancestor. Trying to think. I mean, there have been some interesting ideas for different animals, so different mammals that may have evolved from aquatic ancestors that may have been terrestrial before. So this has been a theory for proboscideans for a while. Some of the earliest elephant relatives look like they're aquatic, so that would imply terrestrial to aquatic. So if you go way back, aquatic to terrestrial, then mammals, and then terrestrial to aquatic, and then aquatic to terrestrial again. I mean, so there are some hypotheses out there for particular groups that have a pretty complicated history. You might have even heard of this aquatic ape hypothesis that doesn't carry much cachet with, I don't think, many anthropologists, but that humans might have even come from aquatic ancestors, those types of things. There are different ideas out there. But I think for cetaceans, it's long been proposed that they had terrestrial ancestry. Yeah, Paul?
Two questions. One, it seems as though there may be sort of two directions whale evolution went. One, with the tail and the legs, you know, going away. The other, the big flippers sort of sets, mm-hmm. And one seems to have won out over the other, at least in terms of modern whales.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an accident of history, or is there perhaps something uniquely superior about one versus the other?
Sure. So this is an interesting question. When you sort of take into account broader patterns that are happening within aquatic animals at that time. So, one of the things I can't do in a talk like this is talk about just how much weird experimentation there was in the semi-aquatic realm. Mm. We have a fossil called Macaracetus, mm-hmm. which looks like it probably had a muscular proboscis on its nose, given these weird excavations on its snout. So this would have been an animal that had been like maybe feeding on clams or oysters or something on the bottom in a weird way. The Remington cetids that I worked on actually show an interesting trend in their neck. Their neck actually gets longer as you work through their history, but I infer that it's to accommodate this big skull. They need the muscle to support it and to move it around. And so there's tons of experimentation that's happening as whales are first adapting to life in water. But there you've got kind of a limited environment and maybe a lot of competitors because it's a limited environment. And out in the ocean, there were not a lot of competitors at the time. Anybody know why? There were all kinds of marine reptiles when the dinosaurs were around. Ichthyosaurs, plesiosaurs, pliosaurs, mosasaurs, and they all went extinct around when the dinosaurs went extinct. So during the Paleocene, from 65 to 55 million years, the only top predators in the ocean were sharks. Sharks have been around for hundreds of millions of years. And so there were several probably wide open niches. They were just sitting there. And so I would expect that when these animals got more and more aquatic, there's abundant food sources, There are not many competitors out there fulfilling those niches, and they kind of just went crazy. That's my kind of take on why things kind of exploded once we got fully aquatic. Yeah?
If I remember way back, it seems like the horse used to be held up as an example of a fairly complete series of evolutionary steps. So compare the two. The completeness of the whales versus...
Yeah, the horses are a really good one, too. One of the other field sites for my lab when I was in graduate school was Wyoming, where they work in the Bighorn Basin, and there are lots of horse fossils there. I got to help with the vertebral interpretation on a horse that's the size of a cat, which was pretty cool. And that was maybe one of the first ones, right? The first sequences where it looks like you could show the reduction in the number of digits, and increasing adaptations, not only within the limbs, but within the vertebral column for running fast and things like that. I still think it's a very good example. But it's also more complicated than how it was initially proposed, just like the whales are. This is a complicated story. We can sort of parse it down and show the trends, but we're looking at adaptive radiations here, where things are adapting and experimenting in all kinds of different ways. And we only have like some of those organisms that have given rise to the things that we have today. The picture with the horses is the same. And there's all kinds of really cool things that you can do with the horse fossil record that looks at forested canopy environments versus grasslands and seeing how horses were adapting early on to these different environments in different ways. And so that would be an equally great example to talk about. It's just not the stuff I do my research on, right? Okay. So, yeah. Scott?
You mentioned at the beginning, like the graphics and everything, there's good literal six-day creationist arguments and there's bad literal six-day creationist arguments. What are some of the...
Okay, so what they're often critical of, where I call them substantive arguments, where I think they're making good points, has to do sometimes with reconstruction, where you're reconstructing an entire animal out of a skull and some teeth, or where the interpretation of the skeleton itself I might call questionable as well. But what they so they'll present those, and there was that one article that said kind of another icon bites the dust. They critiqued like three different fossils that I would say those are valid critiques, and then didn't talk anything about all of the other fossils that actually address all of those questions. And so the critiques are valid, and I think we have actually good explanations or answers for all of them, and that's what I usually don't see addressed very much when I read those articles. Some of them, if I'm honest, are just bad. I had somebody, so there was an article in the Spark a few years ago that highlighted some of my work. And there were some letters that got sent to the alumni office, and I got some emails and some mail in my mailbox here. And somebody sent me a chapter from a book. I don't remember what book it was, to be honest, about whale evolution and sort of questioning it. And it was about maybe 10 or 12 pages. I got through about three pages, and I was tallying all the mistakes. And I didn't finish it because I realized, okay, they actually don't know the data. They don't know the sort of modern interpretations. Often see quotes that are kind of mined from older publications that look really reputable, but they're really out of date, and things like that. And so, yeah, hopefully that answers your question. Sarna?
I just have two basic questions. One is what mechanism do you use to date the fossils in the whale record, like the ones that you're finding in Egypt? And then if I were just to look at some of the pictures you put up there, and I didn't know anything about anatomy, they looked to me a little bit like alligators. And I know you mentioned that there were a lot of very substantive differences between the skeletons of reptiles and mammals. And I was wondering if you could just briefly talk about what are some of the analogous structural differences, I guess,
sure,
that you see between those two.
Sure. So first question with the dating. These are far too old to use like carbon dating or anything like that, because that caps out at about 50,000 years. And so the best way to date these is to have a window to try and date the volcanic ash layer below where the fossil's found and one above where it's found. And so there are people who do stratigraphy, where they go out in the field and they're mapping all the layers and they're taking dates successfully through and presenting an overall interpretation so that when we find these fossils, we can usually actually go to the literature and find out, okay, this is in this part of the stratigraphic column, so this is how we're going to date this here. In terms of crocodiles and cetaceans, I often tell people when they ask, well, what were these animals like? I say they're probably like mammalian crocodiles. They're probably living in shallow water. Some of them, so the Remington Acetus that I work on, their skulls are not particularly strong, but their jaws are built to snap quickly. Because they're these really long, narrow skulls, and all of the musculature is concentrated at the back. So those are animals that I picture living in maybe murky environments. Their eyes are teeny tiny, but they're the oldest whales that have ears that are really well adapted for hearing underwater. I picture them sitting in shallow, murky water. Fish swims up close and snaps, eats it. Then we've got some of these other ones that are big that have been reconstructed, like sitting in the shallows. A little deer-like thing comes to drink water, and then you see this thing like jumping out of the water and grabbing it. They have really heavily built skulls that could have potentially done things like that. And so in terms of lifestyle, in terms of eating fish and maybe some bigger things like that, I think we see a lot of overall skull shape similarities between some of these early cetaceans and crocodiles. There was actually just a paper that came out a month ago maybe. They did a morphometric study of crocodiles with some of these cetaceans and other things and show that they basically have the same overall skull shape, which would be built for eating things like this. In terms of how they move, mammals and reptiles generally move very differently. Reptiles, when they walk, but also when most of them swim, are moving their vertebral column side to side. In mammals, except for the very primitive mammals, like things like platypuses and stuff like that, lateral movement is restricted, and the motion is in the dorsiventral plane instead. And so the way that these animals moved would have been 90 degrees different than they would have been in crocodiles and alligators. And certainly all of the crocodiles and alligators are interesting in their own right, too, because they've got some interesting modifications relative to reptiles as well. From all the reptiles that exist, they probably have the most mammalian skeleton in a lot of ways. They've got differentiated thoracic and lumbar vertebrae, which we usually don't see. They've got a four-chambered heart. Birds have that as well, but crocodiles and alligators have a bunch of weird modifications as well. So, yeah, Dave. So there's just a paper that came out this winter that described what's proposed as the first echolocating whale. And it's based on structure of the face that seems to indicate some of these soft tissue structures that are used for producing the sound, but also having an ear that is specialized for hearing high frequency. So now with like technology, we can do CT scans. And we can actually get the structure of the cochlea in fossil skulls and things like that. And based on the way the cochlea works, you can estimate the range of frequencies that that cochlea in this fossil is going to be sensitive to. So this was like an ultrasonic perception that was possible in this particular whale. It's called Echovenator was what the name that they gave it. And so that's one of the toothed whales that's quite a bit more recent than the fossils that I talked about here. What we do see in these whales that I talked about that I've seen in Egypt and elsewhere, they are hearing in water well because they have a fat pad at the back of their jaw that makes the back of the jaw very, very thin. We see that from Remington acetids all the way up. And their skulls are asymmetrical and directionally asymmetrical, which also helps with perceiving where sound is coming from in the water, because if your skull is perfectly symmetrical, sound coming from over here, you might not be able to differentiate where it's coming from. But if your skull is twisted in a particular way, it actually helps with perceiving where sound is. So the hearing happened pretty early. And especially when we look at Pachycetus, that its ear was modified in some way for hearing in the water. But that sound production in toothed whales like dolphins took a few more million years before we see evidence of that. Do you have a question, Deb? You had your hand up a second ago.
And it's related when you were talking about the horse fossil record mm-hmm. versus the whale fossil record. So sometimes I'll get questions or people will object about, you don't have the full chain. You still have gaps. You don't really know.
Yep.
So what's the right way to word that when explaining it? Is it a population of species that show these trends?
Yep.
And is it still dotted lines between them?
So this is notoriously difficult to do. And what we often say is, okay, if we have a starting point and end point, and there's a gap in the middle, you find a fossil to put in there, and what have you just done? You've just doubled the number of gaps. You fill those in, then it doubles again, right? So speciation and different speciation processes that we can study in modern flora and fauna, it's hard to sort of test some of those questions with the fossil record. Generally, with the fossil record, we we differentiate species based on anatomical differences. That's about as much as we can do. Recognizing that in modern forms, you can have two species that are anatomically nearly identical that don't mate, that are in different species. You might have two skeletons that look completely different, but they're actually the same species because there's so much variance there. And so when we do phylogenetic analysis with the fossil record, we assume actually no ancestry if we're just doing straight parsimony. We're just looking at the basic branching points and relationships without necessarily positing any one of them as an ancestor. Now, there's actually a second method that you can use. It's called stratocladistics, where you can actually use the stratigraphic record to try and help you test ancestor-descendant relationships. And so there you can actually start to sort of maybe, well, are these two like cousins, or is one of them actually the ancestor of the other one? You can actually test some of those hypotheses that way. It's not a super popular method for some reason. I'm not sure why it hasn't caught on. But really, you know, I think it's apt for us to look at any of these transitions as real biological phenomena where they're populations that are adapting for particular ways of life. And you're going to have some that might get geographically isolated or some that start to explore a different niche in a different region. And over time, you're accumulating genetic changes that eventually you'll sort of see the difference manifest in the anatomy and things like that. But it is a pretty slow, still generation-by-generation process. Whenever I give talks like this, I always am quick to say that this is more complicated than this picture, right? We are sort of cherry-picking. I don't want to use cherry-picking. We're picking our best fossils that have the best specimens that are known, where we can see these differences taking place. And you are seeing a pattern. And that pattern is really compelling, and I think the best explanation for that pattern and all of these other patterns that we see is an evolutionary explanation with common ancestry and common descent. I think one of the problems we often run into is people ask questions and want an easy answer. And if we're actually being fair with the data and how things work, there sometimes isn't an easy answer. And I think there are always inferences that we do need to make. But I think when, you know, if we trust the scientific process the way it works, and you have this accumulation of evidence from different fields that are all telling you the same thing, I think the jumps that you need to make to get to a certain inference get smaller and smaller. And I think that's what happens the more we find fossils. Yes, we're creating more gaps, but we're actually filling in some of the details of how you might get from point A to point B. Scott?
Maybe I'm playing better.
I would expect this from you, Scott. Okay.
You kind of, like with the cherry picking, like you're showing the best of the best to mm-hmm. show these trends. Well, what about the worst of the worst? Is there anything in the literature currently that kind of upsets these?
So that's a good question. So Professor Belili, who was in here and had to step out, not calling him out because he stepped out, but because he asked me this question when he came in. Because he had seen a jaw from a basilosaurid whale, and I'd say, like, probably without a doubt, it's from one of these basilosaurid whales. So a fully aquatic whale, a big one, found in Antarctica, and the first date on it was 49 million years. And so creationist organizations actually picked up on this very quickly and said, well, if that's 49 million, a Pachycetus is 50 million, then there's no way that evolution story could have worked. I didn't know much about the fossil. I had only, when it was published, it was just like an abstract from a talk, I think, that I saw. And then a couple years later, it finally came out in a journal that I had a really hard time finding the article because the journal was so obscure. And indeed, they did say that this is proposed to be an Aprisian basilosaurid, which is way earlier than we'd ever seen one before. And so I called and emailed a couple of friends who have done some field work down there. And what they told me is dating stuff in Antarctica because of the way the sediments are is really, really difficult. And so they said, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that date's completely wrong, just because they're misinterpreting the geology. Then a paper just came out this winter that actually formally makes that claim and has a different date for that fossil that is more recent. And that's the way science works. I mean, that's the way it should be done, right? And it's fine to make claims, and if you have evidence for the claims, well, let's see if they hold up. And usually when I look at those cases where they have an argument, when I sort of dig a little bit, usually they don't hold as much water.
Cool.
Yeah, David?
How
many things do you know eat seagrass? Not very much. They're specialists there. So this is also really cool. And we could do this with any one of these aquatic animals. We could do cetaceans. Right? You can check that one off the list. I'll give you all permission. Look into sea cows. Look into pinnipeds, the seals and sea lions. Look into otters. We've got extinct things like desmostylians, which are aquatic mammals that are completely extinct. All of these different independent experiments from land back into water. And Lauren and I were talking earlier, too, that there's often similarities in terms of how things seem to progress or the body shapes or styles that we see in these animals. And that's, I would say, usually due to environmental constraints, right? If you're going to go from land to water, that water is probably going to shape you in a similar way than a previous transition because the demands of living in water dictate that, right? But every single one of these experiments, I say, comes to the party with different baggage, right? They're inheriting a particular set of traits from their ancestor. And so they've got a different toolkit for encountering those same problems. So then we see things happening differently in those different groups because they're adapting to the same problems but in different ways given what they've inherited from their ancestors. So sea cows are really cool. We've got a four-legged sea cow called Pisosiren, which is from Jamaica, that was described a few years back. I saw several sea cow fossils in Egypt that still have hip bones. But what you see is that the hip bones sort of evolved differently than the hip bones of whales did. So you see something happening differently there in that group versus the other, probably due to the way that they developed in the genetics that they've inherited. And I suspect that with sea cows, that was just a niche that was completely untapped. And you see them, you see them all over the world, really. And we don't have a ton of them today, but in the fossil record, there are quite a few. Some of you may be familiar with Steller's sea cow as well, which was this monstrous sea cow that lived in Arctic oceans that humans hunted to extinction because they were so big and easy to kill. And they've got one of those skeletons on display at the Natural History Museum in D.C. if you ever want to see it. It's just, you think a manatee's big. It's nothing, right? So they've got the best collection there of Steller sea cow specimens. This is going on a tangent. It's just really cool. And we've got these cases, right, that we keep the bones in, and a drawer is like this big. And you can fit two Steller sea cow scapulae on there. That's it. Just two. That's how big they are. Dugong scapulas maybe like this big. These things are like serving platters at Thanksgiving, right? You can serve turkey on a Steller sea cow scapula. But they're a cool story in their own right. We just don't have quite as many fossils of them. And that might be an interesting question as to why. But any others?
I was just thinking that there's a parallel there with plants that move into deserts. You have different lineages, and they come with different toolkits, like you said.
Yeah.
And you see some very similar patterns. They need to store water.
Right.
Yeah. All right, let's thank you.
All right, well, thank you.